Hello, and welcome back to Brokenomics. And in this episode, let's get into UBI, or Universal Basic Income. As we know, the Western world has a bit of an excessive debt problem. Now, part of that is caused by our fiat money system, as we've talked about previously. And partly it's because we got these huge insurance programs that are running, and they're basically racking up far too much government spending, and that government spending is leading us deeper and deeper into debt. So when I'm talking about insurance programs, I'm talking about things like pensions, social security. You could probably also include the NHS in that, although it's optional whether you want to bundle that in or not. And it's not just the case for the UK. This is going to be the case for all Western countries. They're all running these big insurance programs that are forcing them deeper and deeper into debt. Now, what that gives you, it gives you the most obvious objectionable bits of it that you see, such as if you know a young person who has somehow actually managed to buy a house, you'll quite often find that they go into these new builds or something like that, and they've spent their whole lives working to build up a deposit, or they've borrowed a lot of money from relatives and they've managed to get themselves into something. They paid a lot of money for it. They're going to be paying a lot of money for it. And next door to them, they've got some welfare with three illegitimate children who has also just been given a house, which can be quite frustrating to see when you've worked just as hard for that same thing. You've got the families where now, and even mainstream media will sometimes report on this, families where they're in the second or third generation of people who have never worked. You know, people who have never worked, their parents have never worked, possibly their grandparents have never worked. Not a good system. As well as that, of course, you've got the pension system. Now, the pension system was designed, basically, the pension system as we know it was designed by the boomers for the generations that came above them. So the greatest generation, the silent generation. The big issue there is that the boomer generation was very large and the generations that preceded them were quite small. And so it was very easy for a large generation to be generous to a small population. But now it's the boomers themselves who are retiring, and it is a lot more difficult for a small number of people to be generous to a large number of people. So this pension system is again something else which is driving us deeper into debt. So the question becomes, is there a better way of doing these social insurance type programs that are less manipulating to incentives? So this is especially true in the welfare case. One way of doing it is potentially universal basic income. It's an idea that has shown increasing popularity. Before I get into it, let's discuss the basics of what it is. So it's basically a cash transfer. It's where every individual receives a fixed, regular, unconditional sum of money from the government or other public institution, but it's probably going to be from the government. And the principles of it are, is going to have to be universal. So everybody gets it, regardless of whether they're employed, unemployed, you know, income, wealth, whatever it is. Everybody gets it. It's universal. It's unconditional. So you're not required to meet certain criteria, such as, you know, means testing or whatever else it might be. And it is a straight up cash transfer. So you're basically just paid money into your bank account, presumably every month or however often it is. Now, the historic background to this idea is actually quite old. I mean, you could link it back to somebody like a thinker like Thomas Paine, who proposed a form of social dividend in, I believe, about the 18th century. And later you could tie it to Bertrand Russell. He talked about this idea as well. And you know, go to say the 60s and 70s, and Milton Friedman proposed a very similar idea, and that's something that I do want to come back to at the end of this. Why it has got more traction in the last few years is because this idea has re-energized in Silicon Valley. Tech-focused people are looking at this a lot. To the extent that Andrew Yang, if you remember him, he made it his signature policy. So Andrew Yang was running for US president in 2020, and his signature policy was universal basic income, UBI, of $1,000 a month. And he was pitching it as a way to handle what existing societal ills as he saw them, and also any jobs who would be displaced by automation. So rather than me try and explain what Andrew was thinking, let's just watch Andrew himself pitch this. Let's watch this, and then I'll catch you on the other side.
When you hear me say, hey, everyone gets $1,000 a month, you're like, wow, that sounds too good to be true. It is not too good to be true. My flagship proposal is a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for every American adult starting at age 18. So that means that you would receive $1,000 a month every month. And this is a renaming of something called universal basic income, a policy that's been with the country since our founding. Thomas Paine was for it. He called it the citizens' dividend. Martin Luther King fought for it in 1967 in his book, Chaos or Community. And it is what he was fighting for every day up to the day he was assassinated in 1968. Milton Friedman and 1,000 economists signed a study saying this would be tremendous for America. And it even passed the US House of Representatives twice in 1971. It came this close to being law. So this is not as radical as you might think. 44% of American jobs will be subject to automation in the next 20 to 30 years, 20 to 30% in the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, think about what that means. The most common jobs in the US economy are administrative and clerical, which includes call center workers, retail and sales, food service and food prep, truck driving and transportation, and manufacturing. Those five sectors are all going to shrink, and that's half of American jobs. And then you're looking at other white-collar jobs like insurance agents and financial advisors and accountants and bookkeepers, radiologists. Like, a lot of professions are going to get affected by this. So the way we fund this universal basic income is that we look up and see who's winning in an era of incredible innovations. Amazon, Google, Facebook, Uber. And then you look closer and you see Amazon paid literally zero in taxes in 2018. How is that possible? How could a $1 trillion tech company pay less in federal taxes than you or your parents? And so the way we fund the freedom dividend is we join every other advanced economy in the world and have a value-added tax that then gives the American public a tiny slice of every Amazon sale, every Google search, every Facebook ad, every robot truck mile, and returns it to your pockets. And there is one state that's had a dividend for almost 40 years where everyone in that state gets between $1,000 and $2,000 a year, no questions asked. Do you know what state that is? It's Alaska. And Alaska funds it with oil money. And what I'm saying to you is that technology is the oil of the 21st century. And what they're doing for Alaskans with oil money, we can do for all Americans with technology money. And here's the great thing. When you get that money, you spend it, it circulates through the economy over and over again. We get back hundreds of billions of dollars in new revenue as a result. We also save money on things like incarceration, homelessness services, emergency room healthcare, and we have a population that's healthier, mentally healthier, better educated, more productive. So this is going to pay for itself in a way that will benefit us all. This is the trickle-up economy, and it starts with universal basic income of $1,000 a month for every American adult starting in 2021, and that is why I'm running for president.
Okay, so that's it in Andrew's words. I do have to push back on the bit about Milton Friedman. As you know, I mentioned him just a few moments ago. He wasn't actually proposing this. He was proposing something else, which we are going to come to. But that's his pitch, $1,000 a month, which he was proposing is funded by adding VAT into the American system. And especially, it looks like it was going to be designed in such a way as it captures a lot of the tech things. So online sales, but also robo truck miles and all the rest of it. Now, in many ways, what he's describing there is pretty much peak democracy, isn't it? Because it is the 51% voting to get the stuff of the 49%. It generated a lot of discussion. Joe Rogan picked it up many times. There's loads of clips of his that I could have used around this time of him asking his guests about it. But ultimately, it didn't work out for Yang. And that's mainly because Democrat primaries are even more fortified than the general. I think it's also because a lot of people recognized the dangers of going down that route. So, you know, once you've got to the sheer brazen point of just taking stuff from the 49% to give to the 51%. And if that's how you start winning elections, well, you know, why doesn't the next guy just offer 2,000? And, you know, and then you're just in a bidding war to essentially redistribute as much as you can from the 49% to the 51%. And the other thing that I really want to push back on is he's wrong, because he was describing this as if it is a new injection of value into society. He seems to be conflating money with real value. Now, money is just a ledger. And if it wasn't, Venezuela would be one of the richest countries on earth, or Zimbabwe, or any other country that has suffered massive inflation. It is just going to be a form of redistribution. But he does have a point about automation. And this is where this has become such a popular idea amongst tech leaders, because look, there are a lot of jobs now being lost through automation. And if that's true in 2020, how true is it going to be over the next couple of years when we are now combining automation with AI as well? So while I'm talking, watch this video that's playing in the background. If you're just listening to this, I'm playing in the background a video of an Amazon factory. Amazon is very interesting because, actually, I covered this in one of the previous episodes of Brokenomics, when we looked at those big ideas, and robotics was one of those five big ideas that we covered in that episode. Amazon has 500,000, so 500,000 robots worldwide, and it replaces 2 million employees, because effectively those robots, they do the work of 4 humans, each of them. And that's partly because they never sleep, so they just go all the time. And partly because they're faster. They don't get in each other's way. They know exactly where they're going every time. They're very to the point. And as you can see from the video, the way that it's being used in this case is basically it brings stuff very quickly, the right things, to a human operative. And the human operative basically just does the sort of fuzzy logic check at the end. Have I been handed a bottle of maple syrup that has cracked in some way, or has it gone bad inside? That kind of the stuff that the humans are good at. But all the legwork is now being done by robots. And Amazon would have to have a workforce instead of 1.6 million of 3.6 million if it wanted to not have the robots. So a lot of jobs are being shifted over into automation. And this is something which is only going to accelerate, especially now once we've got the AI impact to this as well. We're not yet at the point where you can have a robot turn up and fix your broken toilet, but that will be coming. It is just a question of the rate of change on these things and the time it takes to get to it. So I don't know if it's going to happen next year, 10 years, or 100 years, but it is coming. We are on that trend. Now, historically, technological innovations have resulted in a net increase in jobs. Take the classic example of, say, the Luddites. The Luddites were a group of 19th century English textile workers, and they protested against industrialization because what they were seeing was these weaving machines coming in and were threatening their livelihoods. They were named after their supposed leader. I don't know how historically accurate that is, but a guy called Ned Ludd. And they basically went around destroying these threshing machines, these weaving machines, in an attempt to preserve their craft, their artisanship. And they were put down by the British government, but they became this shorthand ever since for people who believe that technology is a net loss of jobs, the Luddites. So you always get accused of being a Luddite if you think this is going to happen. With the risk of that, it may actually be the case that we have now reached the stage of technological innovation where it possibly actually is a net destruction of jobs going forward. It's very difficult to predict at this point because I wouldn't be able to name what jobs would be or even what industries would be created off the back of a revolution in AI and automation. But it's very possible, since those things are essentially designed to replace human labor, that we do see a net reduction in jobs for the first time. So maybe that old smear of, you're a Luddite might not actually be true here. It's very difficult to say in advance, but it could be very true. And even if it's not actually true, even if it does lead to a net increase in jobs going forward, it's very possible that the rate of job destruction for a number of years, perhaps even a decade or two, outstrips the rate of alternative job creation. We just don't know. So it is worth looking at this idea because it is potentially a real challenge that we're going to have to face. And that's what the thinking of a lot of these Silicon Valley guys are. So there's a lot of people that I could draw from to make this point. But since I'm talking a lot about AI in this, let's go to Sam Altman. Sam Altman is the CEO. So he's the creator of ChatGPT that has really spurred this this recent refocus on AI and what it can do. So here's Sam talking about the idea, and you'll get a sense of how tech people are thinking about this. Let's watch Sam.
Proponent of UBI, Universal Basic Income. In the context of AI, can you describe your philosophy there of our human future with UBI? Why you like it? What are some limitations?
I think it is a component of something we should pursue. It is not a full solution. I think people work for lots of reasons besides money. And I think we are going to find incredible new jobs, and society as a whole and people's individuals are going to get much, much richer. But as a cushion through a dramatic transition, and as just like, you know, I think the world should eliminate poverty if able to do so. I think it's a great thing to do. As a small part of the bucket of solutions.
Okay, so that's his take on it. He feels that it might be a part of the solution. And it's not just him. They all think like that. But and it's not just techie types as well. Let's have a look at Ray Dalio's thoughts on the subject. So Ray Dalio is, I mean, he's a big thinker. He's certainly been an influence on my thinking. He's a 70-year-old billionaire hedge fund manager, manages the biggest hedge fund in the world. Ray's seen it all. He certainly understands the big picture. And he's written some fantastic books that I've often drawn on in previous Brokenomics episodes, and I probably will again. So I value his take on it. Now, he also did an interview with the same guy, Lex Fridman, and he sees the automation impact, even though he's skeptical if UBI is the answer. But again, it goes to my point about it. It is a very live debate that we're having at the moment. So let's watch a couple of bits from that interview and what Ray thinks about this.
What's your view on the impact of automation, of whether we're talking about AI or more basic forms of automation on the economy in the short term and the long term? Do you have concerns about it, as some do, or do you think it's overblown?
It's not overblown. I mean, it's a giant thing. It'll come at us in a very big way in the future. We're right at the edge of even really accelerating it. It's had a big impact, and it will have a big impact. And it's a two-edged sword because it'll have tremendous benefits. And at the same time, it has profound benefits in employment and distributions of wealth, because the way I think about it is there are certain things human beings can do. And over time, we've evolved to go to almost higher and higher levels. Mm-hmm. And now we're almost like we're at this level. You know, it used to be your labor. Mm-hmm. And you would then do your labor. And okay, we can get past the labor. We got tractors and things. And you go mm-hmm. up. And we're up over here and to the point in our minds where, okay, anything related to mental processing, the computer can probably do better, and we can find that. And so other than almost inventing, you're at a point where the machines and the automation will probably do it better. And that's accelerating, and that's a force, for the good. And at the same time, what it does is it displaces people in terms of employment and changes, and it produces wealth gaps and all of that. So I think the real issue is that has to be viewed as a national emergency. In other words, I think the wealth gap, the income gap, the opportunity gap, all of those things, that force is creating the problems that we're having today, a lot of the problems. The great polarity, the disenfranchised, not anything approaching equality of education, all of these problems, a lot of problems are coming as a result of that. And so it needs to be viewed really as an emergency situation in which there's a good work, good plan worked out for how to deal with that effectively so that it's dealt with effectively. So because it's good for the average, it's good for the impact, but it's not good for everyone, and it creates that polarity. So it's got to be dealt with.
And you have a certain skepticism that human nature will use, may not always, in fact, frequently may not use that $1,000 for the optimal, to support the optimal trajectory.
Some will and some won't. One of the big advantages of universal basic income is that if you put it in the hands, let's say, of parents who know how to do the right things and make the right choices for their children because they're responsible, and you say, I'm going to give them $1,000 wiggle room to use for the benefit of their children. Wow, that sounds great. If you put it in the hands of, let's say, an alcoholic or drug addicted parent who is not making those choices well for their children, and what they do is they take that $1,000 and they don't use it well, then that's going to produce more harm than good.
Okay, so that's his take on it. And I've got to say, you know, both the characters that we've just had on, I do kind of agree with, you know, the points that they're making to a large extent anyway. The automation, the robotics and the AI thing is a real issue that we want to be thinking about. It has the potential to completely upend, well, basically everything, I mean, all of our economic assumptions. So look, even though I am on record on, well, not only this podcast, but I mean, many podcasts that I've done over the years, not just here, but many other places, I've been extremely concerned about the way that UBI will probably be used as a tool to, well, essentially push us into digital slavery. Especially when you combine it with something like a central bank digital currency, a CBDC. Nevertheless, I do acknowledge that these issues that they're raising are real concerns. That point that he made at the end about it depends who you give it to, what if people use the money inappropriately, that's also an interesting point. So bear that in mind, but I'm going to let Milton Friedman get that one towards the end of the segment. Anyway. So, look, I'm going down lots of tangents on this one. Let's get properly back into the idea of explaining the idea and its attempt to solve a potentially serious issue, and then we can figure out together where we stand on it if we think that this is something which has potential to at least replace the forms of insurance programs that we have at the moment. It's also worth mentioning that various UBI programs have been tried in the past, mixed results on those, but we will pick that up in a moment. So, arguments for universal basic income. So it provides a guaranteed floor that everyone has access to basic necessities, so it will reduce absolute poverty levels, okay? It's an attempt to close income gaps by providing more resources to the poorest, but without complicated bureaucracy or means testing or any of that sort of other bureaucratic rigmarole that goes along with it. And it provides that sort of financial safety net. So you take away that element of stress and anxiety that people have when they have limited financial means. You know, they can often feel trapped in a job or a set of circumstances because it's a choice of, if they give up any sort of situation that they're established in, it's immediately going to zero, where this provides a sort of a basic buffer against it. The automation arguments tend to be, look, as automation and artificial intelligence, or as Elon Musk likes to say, the proportion of intelligence which is not human is increasing all the time. As that trend continues, it gives you a buffer against that. It's a supplement for workers who lose their job to AI or automation. And so it gives them an opportunity to either find something else or do a period of retraining. It gives them, again, that sort of basic level which, you know, essential needs can be met. And also by decoupling work from UBI, work from income effectively, what UBI can do, the thinking is it can help society transition to a future where work becomes potentially a lot scarcer than it is now, if you take the logical conclusion of robotics and AI to where it could go. The more attractive thing, I think, for those of you who perhaps think a bit more like me, is that UBI has the potential to replace, you know, multiple of these insurance programs we talked about, so these welfare programs, and it dramatically streamlines the process and the administrative costs. You know, we spend a lot on the bureaucracy of these programs. We have a lot of people administering them. I remember years ago, I knew a young woman who worked for the Department of Work and Pensions, or whatever it was, the big UK government department that administers all of this stuff. And I can't remember her name. It was something like, Jennifer Randall or something like that. And her email address was jenniferrandall4@departmentofworkandpensions, because there were already three other Jennifer Randalls. And it wasn't a particularly common name. It wasn't a particularly weird one, but it wasn't particularly common. You know, these organizations, they employ a vast amount of people, you know, tens and tens of thousands, who then make these sort of constant decisions about whether you can receive these benefits or you don't get these ones. So there's a lot of is money being transferred from the productive to the unproductive, but a lot of it getting sucked out in the middle by the bureaucratic class. So if you go for something like UBI, yes, it's sort of universal and everybody gets it, and the benefit of that is that you just don't get that sort of great sucking mechanism out in the middle. It's just a straightforward transfer across the two.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.